You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
No one knew what was going on in Christopher Marshall's apothecary shop in Philadelphia in 1776. There were rumors that Marshall was secretly making gold or forging documents. But it wasn't only pharmaceuticals being made in Marshall's shop. It was also politics and history. It's a beast without a head, truly the excrement of expiring genius and political frenzy, deserves more imprecations than the devil. I wish that William Hooper, for history's sake, would have said how he really felt about the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. A craft beer brewer, a doctor, a math teacher, a pharmacist, and Benjamin Franklin. Sounds like a revolution to me. I suppose it's possible to picture what Philadelphia in 1776 might have looked like. It might be easier if you're someone who has visited Philadelphia and seen some of the preserved buildings and streets that are there. But I'm grateful to Braxton Boren and his Sounds of the City Colonial Era blog for a little bit of description about what Philadelphia might have sounded like. Carriages and wagons traveling from the countryside to the wharves along the river, as well as the whip cracks of their driver, continually generated noise. In the first half of the 18th century, streets were not paved, and what pavement was there consisted of what archaeologists call pebble stones, similar to gravel. Dirt and gravel roads provided less rigid surfaces than a hard cobblestone pavement, which would reduce the noise from cartwheels and horses' hooves. But it would produce a slight hiss from the small particles of stone sticking to wheels. But as the city developed more at the time of the Declaration, streets became more uniformly and solidly paved, and wheels were more likely to be lined with iron. Both of those factors increased the radiated noise throughout the city. These sounds, along with the herds of livestock continuously moving, were what residents would have heard. While the carriages heading to the wharves generated noise throughout Philadelphia, the riverfront on the Delaware provided another diverse soundscape. Taverns and grog shops in riverfront cafes contributed to the lower-class reputation of the waterfront, the frivolity, the songs, and the brawls that went along with their wares. The wharves further infused the soundscape with clanking anchors and chains, the groaning of masts and rigging, the speech of sailors and merchants, and the loading and unloading of carriages, wagons, and ships. You see noise referenced. In 1770, the principal of a private academy north of Philadelphia advertised his college as being free from the noise of the city. In a letter to his brother in Rhode Island in 1774, a doctor, Solomon Drone, wrote, "I almost envy you your pleasant situation, remote from noise and confusion. Hear the thundering of coaches, chariots, wagons, drays, and the whole fraternity of noise almost continuously assails our ears." While some scholars have argued that colonial Philadelphia was even louder than a modern urban environment, the crucial difference is not the overall loudness over time, but the different textures of the soundscapes. This is an important point. If you live in a modern city, the noise you hear is characterized by relatively continuous background noise. Engines, generators, ventilation systems. In contrast, in 1776, Philadelphians heard many short, impulsive sounds. Only at the busiest times did the colonial city have enough individual sources of noise to blend into anything continuous enough to be perceived as background noise. May 4th, 1776. Despite the clash of cannon, bayonet, sword, engagement between troops and militias in New England and Virginia, despite towns and localities throwing off the king's rule, despite mobilization all over the continent, it still didn't look like the Congress meeting in Philadelphia would vote to officially declare independence. Now, we know that that would come to happen in 2 months. But on May 4th, it just didn't seem like it then. Pennsylvania had just, in fact, had an election. And you could almost say they voted against independence in that they selected an assembly. And it was an assembly dedicated to reconciliation with the king. Led by the lawyer politician, an American rights pamphleteer, John Dickinson. His government, his assembly, seeking reconciliation now with the king, was in charge. Well, it's important to consider the difference between people like Dickinson for reconciliation and independence and what we might consider loyalists or Tories. Dickinson would have abhorred loyalism. At this time, at least, he wanted reconciliation. He was not a loyalist. He had written a series of pamphlets, The Farmer, which was cited by many other patriots and revolutionaries as an argument for American rights. And most of the loyalists at this time were gone. Some of their lands were seized. You know, a reconciliationist like Dickinson, that means that you understand a rupture has occurred and you understand and have a sense of reality that there's fighting going on, real fighting. But reconciliation also means that you believe there's a chance to cure that rupture. And Pennsylvanians voted for that in May 1st of 1776. But not all Pennsylvanians. Only property owners could vote, and Western areas fervent with independence feeling were not well represented in the way that the Pennsylvania colony was structured. John Adams at this time in Philadelphia, arguing the case for independence, was frustrated. Beyond frustrated. He called Dickinson silly and piddly. Why, with the feeling among the people on the continent, we ought to have our hands months ago on the whole legislative, executive, and judicial power on the continent, raised a naval power, and open our ports wide. But he went on. We ought to have arrested every friend to His Majesty's government and held them as hostages. Adams' letter got out, and the British were sure to print it in their papers, which didn't help the cause. The story of independence is often told as if all the action occurred in a single room, and that minds were changed and people persuaded in that room. I make no mistake, that room in the Pennsylvania State House, we now call it Independence Hall, was pretty important. We got a little bit into the soundscape of Philadelphia, but let's look at the visual scape as best we can with our ears. Right now, I'm looking at a painting by a modern artist, Paul McWilliams, which shows Independence Hall. And you need something like this to try to get a sense of how majestic, but also imposing, this Independence Hall building, Pennsylvania State House, was. It's the tallest thing around. Now, Philadelphia has done a great job of keeping Independence Hall preserved. But one thing that is missing that you get in this painting is how much larger the State House is than anything around it. There's nothing else like it. In the distance, to be sure, you see various row houses. You see houses by the river to the east of the State House where many of the commercial buildings would be. Yet, I think it's important that we look not only at the State House and what happened there, but in the streets where people lived in the row houses, because the action there would determine the signing of the Declaration as much as the back and forth of the wig-wearing gentlemen. Absent the actions of thousands, but particularly an involved hundred or so and what might be called the radicals. You know the names, John Adams, you know Sam Adams, you know George Washington, you know Benjamin Franklin. There are a few more people that are worthy of discussing. The elites could have bickered for months, and Adams would continue to harangue his fellow delegates and write letters back. Thomas Young knew the strong arm of British oppression. Well, because he had felt it on his head. Young's most famous moment came when he stood in front of the Old South Church in Boston and gave a speech. A speech about the evils of British tea and the burden the Tea Acts put on the colonists. And besides, the tea tastes bad and whomp! 2 centuries by the church caught him, beat him, left him for dead. But what Young was doing, despite the result, was all part of a plan. While Young was haranguing these guards, other activists, dressed up like Indians, were, and you know this story, dumping tea into the harbor. Young played his role. And after this, he took his family out from under the redcoats and to Philadelphia. And now he used his excellent organizing skills to recruit men for radical meetings and protests. He was a doctor, a physic, though in that time the profession didn't come with riches and prestige. It was a rough profession, and people had to earn their keep to fight for their place in medicine. And you had to know your botany, your plants, your chemicals. But he loved it. Being a doctor meant one was subject to being attacked, often by other doctors, and one needed to hit back. Yes, there was a lot of early American doctor politics going on. Doctors defended their own recipes and said that others were fools, jackanapes, ignorant empirics. Young was called the one name that sticks today, a quack. This was after Young used a pamphlet to call another doctor in Boston a blockhead when he objected to his own remedies. Being a doctor brought Young, who was originally from the Hudson River Valley, you could say the country in this day, in contact with poor farmers, and it inspired him. Government, he thought, should be open to these people. Government should meet in a large room so that all can view and participate. Lawyers, and this was going to get him in a little bit of trouble, lawyers should be cheaper, so lawsuits and the courts could be open to the poor as well. He was a vociferous reader. He studied Latin and Greek. He went way back in history. Saxons, he said, treated every man alike. It was those Normans who came to England and ruined things, created the nobility, and we are ruined by today. He hung out with Ethan Allen, played violin. It was said he was like some Mozart of the New World. The state of Vermont, the name, was Young's creation. It was a suggestion to Ethan Allen, to spruce up the Green Mountain brand with a little French sparkle. Joining him in Philadelphia was the raucous and ribald Timothy Matlick, a fixture in Philadelphia's many taverns and dark theaters. Everyone knew him. His businesses, his stores didn't do too well. He brewed beer, which was quite popular to pay off debts. And he also had an excellent hand. Indeed, it is Matlock who scribes the Declaration of Independence and is the official scribe of Congress. He was a Quaker, but he had long since been thrown out for spending too much time in business. He was a colonel in the 5th Rifle Battalion, a militia. In Pennsylvania, they nodded to Quaker culture and called them associators, people voluntarily associating to defend the province. That drilled, but also met, socialized, drank, and carried on. James Cannon is another person to know about, too, a math teacher and an associator. He wasn't a loud one, the way Matlack might have been, but he was firm. And in his teaching, like Young's doctoring, he came across many of the working poor and wanted something better for them. Philadelphia, as it stood, was no city of brotherly love. A few merchants had half the wealth, and the rest worked in manual jobs for nothing, and when they couldn't pay their debts, they ended up in the Betterment House. Cannon, along with others, created a manufactory where people who were unemployed could make cloths for domestic consumption. The manufactory also became a center of politics. We spoke of Christopher Marshall's apothecary shop. He was a Quaker, but a fighting one. He had no issue brandishing his sword around Philly streets. That got him kicked out of his friends, but he formed his own friends meeting in 5th and Arch, Fighting Quakers Group. Of all of them, he was the most entrepreneurial success. Marshall's pharmacy, which is going to be run by his sons at this point while he's dabbling in politics, was the first retail pharmacy in America. He would go on to supply the Continental troops with all kinds of things that they needed. Marshall, Cannon, Matlack, and Young, they drunk a lot of coffee together. Here's how the author William Hoagland describes it. The drink's syrupy bitterness and heady heart-thumping buzz were a fad among 18th-century intellectuals. With the American boycott on tea, the brew had patriotic connotations too. Philadelphia merchants, assemblymen, delegates, and dissidents sat around the big urns of the London Coffee House and the Merchants Coffee House, where wine and spirits were also served. The radicals drank at Marshall's pharmacy and at his home and at the American manufactory. They'd spent months in an almost constant state of conversation. One thing I've heard in a different book about beverages that have changed the world is that to get a sense of the coffee at that time, it's not the kind of brewed and filtered coffee that we think of, is you'd almost have to be in one of those offices with the old kind of Mr. Coffee pot where someone has let it sit there on the burner for a really long time, and then you're the one that picks it up for that last 4 in the afternoon cup of coffee and pour it out. And that's the closest to the bitterness and syrupness of the coffee at that time. This group is unsung. Few of them fought in some of the famous Revolutionary War battles, and all of them were essential for the most important decision in America's history. They haven't been written about much. They haven't been, well, I mean, if you study American histories, particularly if you study the independence vote in Philadelphia, you know about them. Matlack is celebrated by the National Archives for scribing the Declaration. You know, they're known to historians. They're not kind of hidden, but they're just not commonly discussed a lot. This group would go on not just to contribute to the independence movement, but to write one of the most controversial founding documents of any state, and would annoy many people by the end of the year. John Adams would be perturbed by them. Benjamin Rush, now their great friend, would be aghast. Thomas McKeon, provincial leader in Philadelphia, a well-known person, would soon take his gentleman leave of their company. But right now, they were all compatriots, and Adams, indeed both brothers, couldn't be more pleased with their work. because John Dickinson had just won a battle, and in a few weeks, they needed to win the war. But we go back to the State House and the meeting of the Continental Congress for the first move, because it's made there. Adams makes a motion that all government in the continent that are deriving their authority from the crown, in contrast with the people's needs, that can't meet exigencies of the time, should be suppressed. It's seconded. And John Adams thinks now he has Dickinson. How can Congress vote against this? Everyone agrees that they're not for the crown. Do they want control of the crown? No. Dickinson is a skilled legislator. He's, for the last dozen years, has been a fixture of Pennsylvania politics. He's the one that dethrones Ben Franklin, who, previous to him, had a lot of control and sent Franklin looking to London for his next gig. Now, Dickinson's a force to be reckoned with. He knows how to debate. He knows what Adams doing very well here. He parries this by agreeing with the motion. As Dickinson says, the government of Pennsylvania is absolutely suited for the times, and it has the support of the people of Pennsylvania, as agreed in the last election. They are not in contrast with the people's needs, and so this motion can pass. Then, inexplicably, perhaps just to get some rest, he goes to Delaware. Terrible timing. John Adams now introduces a second measure, a whereas statement, to attach upon this resolution. Whereas His Britannic Majesty, in conjunction with the Lords of Commons of Great Britain, has by late act of Parliament excluded the inhabitants of these United Colonies from the protection of his crown, and whereas no answer whatever to the humble petitions of the colonies for redress of grievances and reconciliation with Great Britain has been or is likely to be given. But the whole force of that kingdom, aided by foreign mercenaries, is to be exerted for the destruction of the good people of these colonies. And whereas it appears absolutely irreconcilable to reason and good conscience for the people of these colonies now to take oaths and affirmations necessary for the support of any government under the crown of Great Britain, and it is necessary that the exercise of every kind of authority under the said crown should be totally suppressed, therefore resolved, and this would be attached on to the earlier resolution. Now, a whereas statement doesn't make the resolution different, but it does add flavor and adds interpretive context that here is going to be essential, because one of the things that's going on is Dickinson's assembly is part of a proprietary government, all right? The Penns, in the late 1600s, the Penn family acquired from the king the colony of Pennsylvania. They're the proprietor, the owner of that colony. Even at this time, they're still Penns, and they still have ownership. If you own property here, you're paying a small, but not inconsequential, maybe 1% or 2% tax to the Penns. But they derive that authority, the Penns, that proprietary authority comes from the crown. And every time the Pennsylvania Assembly meets, they swear allegiance to the crown, even now. Well, Dickinson's not here to argue. It falls to John Duane, a conservative from New York, to argue against this. Duane says, New York does not have instructions to take such a strong stand. This appears to be a stand for independence, and we don't have instructions to vote for this. But in any case, why all this haste? Why this driving? Thomas McKean answers him. It shows Britain that we are serious. After all, from the reports we hear, Mercenaries are coming. This was the best argument on the independent side. On the reconciliationist side, you had, God, do you really want to take up Britain? Do you really want to create such massive disorder and war in these middle colonies? We understand what's going on in Massachusetts and Virginia. Do you want to bring that to the middle colonies now? That's their argument, and it's strong. The strong argument of the independent side is the Hessians are coming, the Hessians are coming. And indeed they were. Sam Adams now picks his moment. He's not the speech maker, he's an organizer. He thanks Mr. Duane for reading the instructions, but he says what you basically argued is that you have instructions that mean you can't vote. It doesn't mean that you're making an argument against this or not a good one. It's that you can't vote. Great. You can be excluded from this debate. The king has thrown the colonies out of his protection and has answered petitions with fleets and armies and unscrupulous foreign hirelings. Why would any American support a government operating under British authority? I'm amazed, Samuel Adams said, that the people have put up with us this long. When the people rebel, know that it's because they've had enough. And so James Wilson of Pennsylvania, in Dickinson's absence, speaks for him in Pennsylvania. I mean, this is where the TV musical 1776 gets at least a little bit right, where they have Wilson famously puppeting everything that Dickinson says. It's at least true at this time. It will change. Wilson says, you know, look, you're making an argument that doesn't apply to Pennsylvania. In other places, there was only royal government. So each colony formed a state. That happened all over New England. It happens in South Carolina, where they're going to say, look, there's just no authority here. The king has left authority, so we have to have authority. We're forming a government. That's not true in Pennsylvania. We've always had a stable government here. This doesn't apply to Pennsylvania. There's no reason to suppress governments just because they get authority, you know, originally from the crown. Richard Henry Lee catches him in this argument. Well, Wilson, you're arguing the original resolution. That's already passed, not the whereas statement. Seeing how this going, Maryland's delegates, who at this time do not have instruction for voting for independence, and this feels like an independence vote, pick up their papers and walk out. Nobody's flustered. And in a vote of 6-4, the whereas statement passes and is attached to the motion.
Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, it's Bruce. Listen, we all know the news headlines are full of wild stories, like how the world is tipping towards authoritarianism, all while somehow, simultaneously, freezing, flooding, and on fire. It's a lot to take in. But what if, instead of being on the brink of disaster, we're actually on the cusp of a better world? If I've got your attention, then I highly recommend tuning to a podcast that offers a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people. What Could Go Right is the acclaimed news podcast from the Progress Network. Zachary Karabell and Emma Varvalukas dive into the biggest news and most pressing topics of our time, from climate change to politics, and make the case for a brighter future. Season 5 features fascinating guests like democracy scholar Yesha Munk on the hidden perils of identity politics, and NPR anchor Steve Inskeep about the importance of talking to people who differ from you and what Abe Lincoln learned from those conversations that helped him unify the country. It's time to ditch the doom-scrolling polarization and start focusing on some of the things going right. So check out What Could Go Right wherever you listen to podcasts. Okay, but this is kind of the, again, we're talking about the elite stuff going on in the state house, in the room. This would be a very empty gesture, this little legislative victory, and pretty easily quelched once Dickinson got back if there weren't other activities going on. As this is going on, there are meetings in the Christchurch schoolroom, which they're using temporarily for some of the radical meetings. There's meetings of the City Committee of Philadelphia, which is now pretty much run by artisans and mechanics who are gunning for independence. The City Committee says, "Thank you, Continental Congress, for this statement that you have passed. We will act on it, and we will now throw out the Pennsylvania Assembly government, because even though there was an election, that government gets its authority from the Crown, and as you say, anything that gets its government from the Crown must be thoroughly suppressed." So it's the Philadelphia City Committee that decides to do it and call for a provincial convention. By the time Dickinson is back to convene his new assembly, this is May 20th, 1776. Okay, it's 19 days after he's won an election, he thought. There's a crowd in the state house yard. Thousands of people, maybe 4,000 by some estimates, demanding a new government. Cannon, Marshall, they're all there. Despite it raining and shouting, haranguing, even shouting down a few people who are there disagreeing, they issue the state house yard resolutions demanding that there be a new government in Pennsylvania. The state house yard resolutions, the meeting there, is not taught in the same way that what's going on in the room is. We hear about the signers, we don't hear about the 4,000 people, but they're important too. I mean, if you go on that Independence Hall tour, and you should, make a point as you're waiting in line to kind of step out and look at the grass area in the state house yard and think about it for a second. I mean, for a lot of people, this is just going to be what you see as you're waiting online. I want to get into the hall and see where the chairs are. I mean, it's a way of kind of physically doing big man history and little man history in a way. Both are important. You walk to the state house yard, you're going to see where the people were protesting and developing resolutions, resolving to make Dickinson's life a living hell, and go back into the room and see where the big men, the elites, did their signing and their voting and their debating. Yeah, there would be no Pennsylvania signatures on the Declaration and no votes on the July 2nd vote from Pennsylvania, and thus, really, no independence vote in 1776 if this protest didn't pressure Dickinson's assembly in this way. Now, Dickinson's a smart guy, so he tries to make some steps. Like, okay, I see the oath is a problem. This assembly is not going to take an oath to the crown anymore. Word gets out about that, and nobody's too impressed. They're like, well, your authority is still initially coming from the crown. Other states have provincial conventions running the state. Dickinson tries one more play. He has his assembly upstairs pass a note to the Continental Congress downstairs in the state house with a request for clarification of that whereas statement. See, he's not fooling around. He knows that while Congress could pass such a statement like that, very vague, very general, but nonetheless hurtful, that a specific clarification, right? He wanted Congress to specifically say whether they felt the Pennsylvania vote should be abolished. Were they saying that the vote taken on May 1st wasn't legitimate? Were they saying the assembly was incompetent? Were they attacking the character of the men in the assembly? You can see what he's doing. But the answer to him comes not from downstairs, and not from an explanation that could look like backtracking from the Continental Congress, but from the more radical City Committee of Philadelphia. The Congress, they say, must not clarify. They have spoken. Now it's up to the people of Pennsylvania to clarify in a provincial convention. There's still a lot of maneuvering, and one of the things that's going on is there are enough people supporting independence in the Pennsylvania Assembly upstairs that they simply don't show up. And now Dickinson doesn't have a quorum to operate. And there's one more demonstration, again a demonstration not well known. The military, the militia, the associators of Pennsylvania are called to muster on the Commons, June 10th, 1776. This is right in front of Independence Hall. Dickinson, by the way, is a militia officer, and he has to and does join them. But in addition to mustering for the militia and showing their might and brandishing their weapons and the like, each battalion is polled for what they want, and each of the battalions demands a provincial convention. So this committee of privates, an extra-legal but somewhat democratic vote of the fighting men, cannot be ignored. I mean, think about today. Think about how powerful it is when a veteran makes a statement. Think about how powerful it is when these are the people that are going to come to the defense of the colony, and this is what they want. Not easy to ignore. Between this meeting of the privates and the assembly being plagued by dissension and the absence of members and making quorum difficult, so we see these political and military aspects to the founding of the United States. The rest we know, a vote July 4th, and soon after that, Pennsylvania has its provincial convention in the Carpenters Hall. And it's decided to have a state constitutional convention. With the radicals now in control of the majority of the state constitutional convention, they meet in the Carpenters Hall. While Continental Congress is still meeting down the street, Benjamin Franklin is the president of this convention, and he's associated with this document, though many current accounts don't really find him being all that involved. Supportive of the final product, yes, but not all that involved. He's very frequently going over to the State House. He's talking about international relations. He's already got his mind on diplomacy with France rather than the intricacies of state government. Cannon, Marshall, Young, these are the people that are involved. Thomas Paine has an influence. These are the people that are involved in writing this Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. All men are equal. It's still saying free men, so we're talking about white men can vote. This sounds like not very much at all, but this is a huge innovation in 1776 because in most places you're only able to vote if you're of property, and sometimes there's a limit to how much property. There's a quota. There is a unicameral, one legislature, one assembly, and it is pretty much all-powerful. It appoints the executive body. It taxes. It spends. It appoints judges. And they serve for a 7-year term. But if the legislature doesn't like them, they can remove those judges. There are a couple checks, though, on this all-powerful body. The members of the legislature only serve for 1 year. So they have to keep running for election. Legislature appoints an executive, but it's not a single person executive, it's a council. And then one person will be the president of that executive. Okay, here's some of the notes in this radical constitution. that all men are born equally free and independent and have certain natural, inherent, and inalienable rights, among which are the enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. That government is or ought to be instituted for the common benefit, protection, and security of the people, nation, or community, and not for the particular emolument or advantage of any single man, family, or soft of men who are a part only of that community, and that the community hath an indubitable, inalienable, and indefeasible right to reform, alter, or abolish government in such manner as shall be by that community judged most conducive to the public weal. And it goes on. Elections ought to be free. Every member of society hath a right to be protected, enjoyment of life, liberty, and property. That in all prosecutions for criminal offenses, a man has a right to be heard by a jury, jury of his peers, jury, impartial jury of the country. That people have a right to hold themselves, their houses, and papers and possessions free from search and seizure. People have a freedom to speak. That people have a right to freedom of speech and of writing and of publishing their sentiments. Freedom of the press ought not to be restrained. That the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state. And as standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty, they ought not be kept up. And that the military should be kept under strict subordination and governed by civil power. So, yeah, I mean, you do see actually in this Pennsylvania 1776, that's one of them that's listed, and this is not a southern state. So it's something definitely to consider in part of the gun debate. One thing you can say for context there is that there is a direct connection in what is Article 13 of the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776 between the right to bear arms and the reason for it, that the people have a right to assemble together, to consult for their common good, to instruct their representatives, and to apply to the legislature for redress of grievances by address, petition, or remonstrance. Now, there is one controversial part of the 1776 Constitution. Not everyone agreed with it, not even among the Matlock and Young. Certainly Thomas Young wouldn't agree with this section, but a quorum of the House of Representatives shall consist of 2/3 of the whole number of members elected, and having met and chosen their speaker, shall each of them, before they proceed to business, take and subscribe, as well, the oath or affirmation of fidelity and allegiance hereinafter directed. I do believe in one God, the creator and the governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good and the punisher of the wicked. And I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. Good God, John Adams says, when he sees what the men who a few months ago he was working with have now done. The whole experiment of independence, he thinks, is in jeopardy. He thinks that in a few years, the people of Pennsylvania will be petitioning Great Britain to save them from this horrible assembly. He publishes his own thoughts on government, which few people read, and he pushes for a less democratic government in Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, they do in 1780 pass their constitution and limit voting to property owners. For Benjamin Rush, this is a mobocracy that has taken over Pennsylvania. And for William Hooper, signer of the Declaration from North Carolina, who is in Philadelphia at this time, it has made more Tories than Lord North. A beast without a head, among other things. Thank you. Yeah, what's so radical about the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776? I mean, today it seems academic, really. Everyone can vote. Yeah, we agree with that. We even want more people to vote than they did then. One-year terms? It's a little much. It's a lot of electioneering. But, you know, it led to having seven presidents of Pennsylvania just in 12 years. But, okay. No governor. Unicameral. Well, there's still a unicameral legislature in Nebraska. You know, what was really radical was the idea of democracy, of equality of station. And I'll read a bit from Philip Klein's History of Pennsylvania. Towards the end of the Revolution, the radicals fell from power in Pennsylvania. By 1781, their paper money and legal tender system collapsed. The voting power of the radicals rested primarily in the state militia, and the militia took its orders from the county lieutenants, who were appointed by the Supreme Executive Council and served as local political bosses. For this reason, the radicals gave little support to the Continental Army, but strongly encouraged everything which would strengthen the state militia. The radicals told militiamen not to receive any insults from Continental officers, even the greatest of them. In 1771, radical mobs in Philadelphia finally touched off a local civil war. They set out to intimidate major Republican leaders. An armed mob headed for the homes of James Wilson and Joseph Reed and had begun to destroy them when the Republican Silk Stocking Brigade of City Light Horse rapidly converged on the scene, equipped with artillery. After a gunfight, the mob retreated and later sated their anger by assaulting General Arnold. The protracted rowdiness of city mobs at length broke the radical power, for everyone could see that the Republican warnings of mob rule had been proven true. Sure enough, in 1790, with McCain and Benjamin Rush involved, conservatives would take over and actually change the Constitution. They would restore a governor, and they would introduce two houses, not just one, a Senate and a House. But one thing that they did not do, they kept the vote. So the 1790 Pennsylvania Constitution and the 1776 retains what many other states still don't have, and that's the right of all free men to vote. Now, it is free men. It's not women, and it's pertaining to white men. However, one thing that was accomplished by the so-called radicals under this Constitution is a gradual emancipation law in Pennsylvania, and anyone born after 1780 would no longer be a slave. It's not perfect. It's in a colony where the population of slaves is not large, where there had already been existing abolition movements, but it is a significant achievement that would set the model for other states, at least in the North, to follow. They're also able to finally get rid of the proprietary nature of Pennsylvania. And they pay a large sum to the Penn family still existing. They absorb all of their lands and end the practice of paying the quint rents, or, you know, the small payments going to the proprietors. And the Penns are still there, but they have their smaller estates. Top of that, they successfully prosecute a war, contribute to the Continental Army, albeit mostly through their state militia structure, protect the heartland of Pennsylvania generally from invasion. And I think the greatest achievement of the Constitution was that Pennsylvania radicals set a path that eventually all parts of the new United States would follow, that everybody gets to vote. And eventually, that would extend to really everybody. And they set a standard that's such an important value for us now, even if it's not something that all the wig wearers actually agreed with at that time. And it's not something that, you know, 11 years after this radical Pennsylvania Constitution, when the federal constitution is adopted, it's not something that they needed to insist on. There's nothing in the Constitution that says all people can vote. It just guarantees a Republican government. I bring up this experiment in Philadelphia because it gives life to the debate about republic versus democracy. You know, what are we? We have a United States, a republic. The republic to which it stands is what you take the pledge to, right? Its foundation, though, is a democracy. Everywhere in all of our documents, there are references to it, even if not directly, even if the word isn't used. We the people. The debate is too simple, I believe, when one just says, this is a democracy. Or the debate is too simple when one says, it's a republic, get used to it. In Pennsylvania, there was an attempt to form the closest to a democracy as possible. Still not a direct democracy. I don't think there's much history for that other than some of the New England town meetings or various localities. But the closest that you could think of, that people would be elected just for a term of 1 year and that people would continuously get the ability to vote. You know, I've said this on other casts. We don't think of common sense as a founding document, and perhaps we should. In as much as we consider those Federalist Papers and as much as we consider the constitutional text and the Declaration of Independence, why not look at common sense? It was the most popular pamphlet of many spread all throughout the colonies, north to south, and it was the one that achieved the most buy-in from those people who decided to seek independence. Leaders didn't always like democracy. If you remember my conversation with Professor Cartledge from Cambridge University, he made reference to your founding fathers were not interested in democracy. That's why they saw the Romans and the Republic of Rome as such a good example. But I think it's worthwhile to ask the question is, what about everybody else? Sure, the elites perhaps didn't like democracy, but how'd the people feel in 1776? How'd the soldiers that fought in the Revolution feel? I mean, can we get a better sense of that? The experiment in Philadelphia in 1776 that we talked about today demonstrates that it was at least an attempt by one of the leading colonies that would become states, driving independence, to provide a vision of what a new type of government would look like. You can ask the question, do we listen to John Adams grumbling or to the people in the state house yard? A logical answer is both. Things are not so simple. So you see this debate go on every republic. Democrat. I think it really heated up after the election of 2016, like most things did, and the result of the Electoral College, and why do we have it, right? It's not democratic. Here's what Lawrence Lessig said, and I kind of like this because I think there is a false dichotomy with this debate. Yes, we are a republic, Lessig says, which means, yes, we are a representative democracy, which means, on the logic of a Ford truck is a truck, yes, we are a democracy. We are just not a direct democracy, Lessig says. And I don't know anyone who ever said that we are. I'd be happy to join with anyone who would argue that we should not be. The Federalist 14, James Madison, says, the true distinction between these forms was also adverted to on a former occasion. It is that in a democracy, the people meet and exercise the government in person. In a republic, they assemble and administer it by their representatives and agents. He also cites Blackstone, democracy, that the choice of ministers may be made either personally by the whole body of the people or by their deputies, chosen for that especial purpose, and in whom they can repose a proper confidence. Now, I've also read opponents who cite different quotes and also have this fact. In fact, the word democracy does not appear in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, or any of our founding documents. James Madison, in a different Federalist paper, says, measures are too often decided, not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. And there can be no doubt that James Madison was concerned about majorities. He was concerned about states. Some of his opinions, some of his letters to Washington wouldn't fit very well with, say, states' rights today. I mean, he was seeking the beginning of a federal convention to clamp down on some of the state's behavior, particularly those Rhode Islanders and what they were doing with paper money and other things. similar to Lessing's analogy, one analogy I like to use is that there's no need to call a square a rectangle, but it is. If you have a republic, there isn't a republic where some king is picking the people who are going to represent the people, right? So if you have a republic, it is in its nature a democracy. And so these terms get confused, and probably better to have debates about what you really want to have a debate about, whether you'll agree with the Electoral College system, whether you agree with the way the Senate is set up. Those are the direct debates to have rather than this abstract, whether we live in one place or another. You know, we live in a republic, so shut up type arguments that you hear sometimes. If you look at the linear progress of the country and then say, where did we start from and where are we now? The movement has always been towards democracy and not towards some kind of Roman Senate type republic idea that seems to be in the minds of so many when they're kind of using the republic argument to limit somebody's want. There's been movement in the direction of more democracy, gradually allowing everyone to vote, the nation allowing women to vote, the civil rights movement, the Voting Rights Act, the disdain in which the majority of the nation viewed the Jim Crow laws, even though in their localities they were allowed to proceed, the 17th Amendment expanding popular vote to senators, taking it away from a few people in a state legislature, the primary system allowing more votes even before nominees are made. All of the movement is in that direction. And so that alone, I believe, is an argument to why we do have a democracy. However, it's a little difficult. It might be easier now than ever to have everything done by an internet vote, say. But, and then during your lunch hour, you can keep up with what Congress is doing and weigh in on it, right? That's technologically possible now. So it's still not advisable. It's still difficult to work to have some kind of direct democracy. But as much democracy as possible seems to be the way to go. And this early example provides at least one vision, however unsuccessful, that was attempted at the founding of the country. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. And please consider subscribing to the premium podcast. A thank you to those who have. It can be as little as $2 a month, more if you want more. www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpoliticspremium.com. Thanks for listening.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.